Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Placer. I am the owner and lead writer of Game Wisdom. Today, we've got a shortened podcast. Ken is MIA at the moment, but fortunately, I have returning guest and fan of the site, Larson Poirier, to provide backup.
Hey, it's great to be back again.
Yep, it's great to have you. Hopefully, you are keeping cool during this incredibly hot summer.
Barely, but I'm surviving.
Yeah, and we are actually recording on Sunday because it seems like everyone else is apparently on vacation for these last 2 weeks. So it's been kind of challenging getting new guests on. But hopefully once everyone gets back to work, they'll be more willing to come on and talk. All right, so we're going to move along pretty quickly today. And for news, the piece that I found that was somewhat interesting was the firing of Nintendo's, I guess, head indie guy, Dan Adelman, who has left the company, looks like according to news, after working there 9 years. So, looking at the story, it's kind of interesting what's been happening with him. He was apparently banned from posting on Twitter by Nintendo because they didn't like him talking about some of their policies on there. And this definitely sort of, I guess, keeps in line with Nintendo's issue with trying to, I guess, you know, open up and be a lot more, I guess, less transparent compared to other companies. And it's kind of interesting when you look at Nintendo versus like a company like Valve or even a lot of indie developers these days who have basically made a business being very transparent with their designs. Larson, are there any like indie developers that you like because of their transparency and how open they are?
Edmund McMullen, the guy who created Binding of Isaac,
He
talks and posts stuff, and he's very, you know, he talks to fans, answers questions. I really like that about him. Keeps us updated.
And it's interesting you brought Edmund McMullen up, because he was one of the developers who also spoke ill of Nintendo's online policies and their Wii Store restrictions regarding, I think, Super Meat Boy and the Binding of Isaac, and how neither game was going to appear on Nintendo due to their restrictions, both in terms of technical limitations and content, because obviously the Binding of Isaac is not exactly a family-friendly game.
Oh yeah, it's been banned. Well, it's blocked from coming onto any Nintendo product now because it has references of religion, which is what they try to avoid at all costs.
And Nintendo is sort of like really biting themselves by just like trying to be family friendly and trying to, I guess, remain relevant, because there was that whole controversy regarding the Tamagotchi Life game, and because of the fact that they weren't allowing same-sex marriages or relationships on it. And Nintendo tried to defend it by saying they wanted to remain, you know, family friendly, you know, PC. They didn't want to, you know, rock the boat. But then, of course, they did by basically not recognizing a major change that's happening in society.
Yeah, I had a feeling, I got a Wii during, like, launch day, and within a year and a half to 2 years after that, I have been a Nintendo fan person since I was born. Like, I played the Super Nintendo Wii, my brother got the 64, I got a Game Boy Color, DS, Game Boy Advance, I got everything. And then once, 2 years after the Wii happened, I was like, you know, this isn't like, I stopped liking Nintendo at that point, just because I had a feeling that they just weren't, like, you know, they have, like, cool technology, like the Wii certainly was, but it's just, like, they're not moving along with everybody else, they're not developing things that, that are as interesting. But, you know, I kind of mentioned this all before on the other podcast, but I really, really slammed them hard for, what, the Wii U or something, and all the, like, their titles they have, or the titles they don't have.
Yeah, I think you were talking about a lot of the all the stuff from E3 was just, you know, reskins or rebranding of other Nintendo characters. Like, the only actual new game was, I think, that Splatoon game that was announced.
The guy that left Nintendo, Dan, right?
Yeah.
He said, I was about to go into a topic about this. I forgot where I was going to go with that, so you can excuse me.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, as you said, Nintendo's really having a hard time staying relevant, I think, with a lot of core and hardcore gamers. And we've talked about this as well in previous casts, that at this point, there's just no way in hell Nintendo will have a number one console. It's just not possible, dude. And the only thing they can hope for is to be either number two or maybe even number three if we count PC in the mix.
Ooh, I think it's a bit steep because, I remember what I was going to say, but I can add into here, is that Dan had actually said in his interview with Kotaku or whoever, whatever source Kotaku used, was was that Nintendo was really only putting out reskins and rehashing, and there's nothing new, there's nothing to attract new people. It's just that Nintendo is literally piggybacking on consumers that have name brand loyalty to games, and that's not necessarily to Nintendo. That is to Super Smash Brothers and Super Mario, and that's about where it ends. And Legend of Zelda, of course.
Yeah, and that is definitely almost like a double edged sword for Nintendo. I mean, we've talked about this on previous casts when I talked with Chris Park from Ark, and we both love Nintendo when they try to do something out of the box. You know, games like Kid Icarus Uprising or the designs of Smash Brothers. Like, these are very well-designed games. They appeal to multiple levels, and Nintendo's game design is still one of the best. But on the flip side, they seem to stop making risks. Like, it seems like you need to, like, force them to make a new game, a new character. And trying to go through my, like, encyclopedia of game releases, I'm having a hard time remembering the last time Nintendo actually made an original character. If I'm thinking right, I think that would be, like, Pikmin for, like, what, 2002, 2003 on the GameCube?
Yeah, because, I mean, when I think of original characters for Nintendo, like, I was going to say that adventure game that was an indie developer. It wasn't even Nintendo. It was, like, Kid Icarus. It was something else. But even then, Kid Icarus is a reskin, or, well, it's a same character just from the Super Nintendo's era, you know?
Nintendo, actually, for Kid Icarus.
Yeah. Original, sorry.
But yeah, it's the point still stands, though, that even, like, when we complain about Square Enix, you know, they may be up to the 14th, they're probably working on a 15th Final Fantasy, they still do, like, wildly different things. So you can't say that Final Fantasy IX, it looks exactly like Final Fantasy X or 8 or whatever. But with Nintendo, if you look at, like, Super Mario Sunshine, Mario Galaxy, New Super Mario, they all look very similar in design, or very similar in art style, that it does start to, you do almost get fatigue from just the constant rebranding and reskinning.
Yeah, like, I got a chance to play that new Super Mario game on the Wii U at a friend's house. You know, the one with the cat suits, which is completely awesome. But when I looked at it, it looked just like the same exact new Super Mario Bros. From the Wii, just instead of having it be a 2D side-scroller, it was like a pretty plain 3D platformer.
Yeah, and this goes back to, I think, one of the posts I wrote about Nintendo, is that they're trying to only appeal to a young demographic, because that's what they think their audience is, but a lot of us, like including you, we've all grown up. We want to see new stuff from Nintendo, and they're just keep appealing to younger and younger audiences, and I think part of it is that they don't know how to do it, or they're scared, you know, that they may run into, like, another Tamagotchi incident. You know, they try to make a mature game, or they try to avoid or get around their family-friendly image.
And to me, that's just extremely sad, because it's like, I don't know, like, when people say family-friendly, it's like, yeah, you can have family-friend games, but you can also make mature games, like, just as fine. But, I mean, like, that isn't even the point, is, like, oh, I want a rated M game where I shoot and kill people. It's like, you know, maybe go out of the box a little bit. Like, the amount of money I spent on Steam so far this year alone is abysmal. Like, I could have probably easily bought, like, a new computer with it. And that's revenue that Nintendo is missing out, because they are only redoing the same things over and over, and their only demographic is children at this point. There is no, it's like, oh, if you're an adult and you used to play with us, well, I hope this is, like, not nostalgia for you. It's like, no, it's not. It's just boring, because I played it before.
Yeah. And when we look at some, like, even games that I do like Mario Galaxy, even when they try to aim for all audiences, it's sort of, like, hidden or set aside compared to targeting younger kids. I mean, when you look at the end of Mario Galaxy and Mario Galaxy 2, it is a very hard game. But then again, you have to spend 4 or 5 hours or even more, depending upon your skill level, to get to that point. It's not like they designed the game for all audiences to begin with. And that's another thing that I think a lot of people are getting tired of with Nintendo, is that you sort of have to find, or you have to work to get to the good stuff.
Yeah, that is something I can definitely agree with you on that. It's just, it's just like, It's frustrating because I had loved Nintendo the moment I got to play Super Mario World on the Super Nintendo, and it was just disappointing to, like, you know, play Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess on the Wii. Mm-hmm. That was pretty awesome. And then there's not really many titles I can think of that I played else on there. Mm-hmm. Like in this, like they're not memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly as fun.
Yeah.
And it's just so sad to see, like, such a great company, like, been digging its hole for the past, what would that be now, 7 years?
Oof, let's see. GameCube, I think, was early 2000, I think 2000, 2001. So,
and I'm pretty sure the Wii came out in, Christmas of 06.
Yeah, 06, 07. Yep, and let's not forget about Wii U's brand issue that a lot of people still don't know the Wii U's a new system. They see it as, you know, an upgrade or, you know, still part of the original Wii. So Nintendo's just not having a good time. I think this sort of goes back, or this sort of encapsulates, Nintendo really is stuck in the past in a lot of areas. I mean, we complain a lot about their online requirements, you know, the whole friend code system.
I think
the guy, Dan Allman, complained about that as well. He actually complaining about region locking on Nintendo, which is just very stupid in this day and age. Which, for those of you... Yep.
That is actually the comment that got him banned from Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he responded to someone, because someone had said about... Has said specifically, it's like, oh, well, I'm kind of, like, sad about the region lock thing. And he's like, oh, yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was enough for him to get banned forever from Twitter.
Nice. But, yeah, I mean, when we look at, like, 2 years ago with Xenoblade, or last year, Xenoblade Chronicles, I mean, when your entire fan base is screaming at you to release a game, you know, debate about that, you release the damn game. Because, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, like, I had a really good friend of mine. He imported Xeno Chronicles, mm-hmm. Xenoblade, and that one other game that everyone was throwing a fit about, and he bought a Japanese Wii to play it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was able to buy that, order it, get it over here, and beat it way before Nintendo even announced that they were going to, like, release one of them
mm-hmm.
in America. And it's like, if your fans are doing that, you're obviously missing out on something. Like, you are not thinking all the way through about mm-hmm. what you are saying to us and what your actions are. Like, they've just gone downward as a company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just keeps, I mean, we could probably spend the next hour or two just going down the checklist of all the little mistakes Nintendo keeps making. But, yeah, it just goes back to the fact that they're not trying to change, or not trying to grow as a company. And probably, like, the best counterexample of that would be what Valve has done over the years. Valve has consistently been on the forefront of change and, you know, throwing stuff against the wall to see what sticks. And, of course, some of it doesn't work out perfectly. There, you know, there's been so much criticism over early access on Steam. But then again, when you look at what they've done that has worked, you know, achievements, trading cards, just Steam's functionality as a whole, I mean, they've gone from being a developer to being one of the driving forces of the game industry in what, like, less than 20 years. I mean, they've become almost as big and recognizable as Nintendo, maybe even more so at this point.
Absolutely, over the general population, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I guess with Nintendo, like, as you said, their brands are just, I mean, they're popular brands. No one can deny that Mario, Zelda, Metroid are big moneymakers, but it seems like they could do more with them. So I guess this brings up a question. I think I may have asked you this on the previous cast, Lorson, but what do you think about Hyrule Warriors, the Dynasty Warriors Zelda mashup?
At this point, I really see it as a gimmick to get people to buy a Wii U to play a Zelda title.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm so disappointed with them. Like, it's not, like, they can release a whole new Zelda on there, and I don't even think I'm gonna look. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not even gonna, like, look back at this point.
Yep, I still haven't played Skyward Sword yet for the Wii.
And I haven't either. Yeah. And I wanted to so bad, and then I was like, I don't. Mm-hmm. I just don't anymore.
Yeah. And, I mean, with the Wii U, like, I'm with you, Lorson, on the whole Steam. I mean, who knows how much I've spent so far on Steam between the summer sale, and, you know, we still probably got a fall sale for the year is up. Well, I probably have spent enough that I could buy a Wii U. In fact, like, 4 months ago, I saw that a Wii U was on sale for, like, $200, $250 on Newegg, and I thought, it's very tempting, but then again, what am I going to play on it? I mean, I couldn't think of, like, 5 or 6 games that I was dying to play. I mean, Mario Kart 8, it sounds like a great game. I heard people are liking it, but is that really enough to, you know, convince me to shell that money? And then on the flip side, my 3DS has been seeing a lot of stuff, a lot of movement on that. Because, I mean, I love, like, the Atlas RPGs. I just bought the Phoenix Wright game. I'll probably get the Phoenix Wright Professor Layton game when it comes out. But it seems like the problems that Nintendo's having on the consoles isn't happening on the handheld. And I think part of that has to do with the third-party popularity. We're seeing a lot of developers make quality games on that while they're sort of, you know, just like shuffling their feet on the Wii U.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just, there's like so much potential for what I think would be for the Wii U if they would make games that would be more like that target, be more like adults. Like, they could come up with so many more games on there and it would be awesome. Like, I would, you know, like I always mention this, Dungeons and Dragons. I would love to have some kind of role playing game on there, like Dungeons and Dragons or, or just one of many of the other systems. You know, that'd be so sweet because it'd be easy. Or even like some kind of fun, like quest game where you play with like you and like three other people or four other people, kind of like Evolution, which will be coming out, I think, the end of this year for on Steam.
Are you like, talking about the Left 4 Dead, the guy from Left 4 Dead developers?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to be a great game, I can already tell. Well, I'm hoping anyway.
Yeah, spoiler, I'm not in the alpha, so I have no idea, so I can't tell you.
The alpha's already out. I didn't even know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, you could sign up, I think, a month ago, and then they started releasing the keys, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I missed out. Yeah. That would have been so sweet to be in the alpha.
Yeah, I know a few friends who got in, but of course, they're not saying a damn thing. But yet, Nintendo has just not had good luck, and it's very similar to what we're seeing with a lot of AAA developers, like EA, Activision, who are just trying to, you know, they're trying to sustain themselves on the same properties and the same brands. I mean, EA, instead of creating an original game about cops versus robbers, they've just created, you know, Battlefield Hardline. So that's another Battlefield game. And speaking about EA, I wanted to mention this earlier, but I just want to let you know, Lorson, I did see SimCity 5 on sale again. I was thinking about you. I was looking at the store page and go, if I bought this, I think Lorison would come and kick my ass.
I most likely would. I would find out where you lived from Ken, and I would come find you.
Yeah.
And I would tell you how bad of a choice that was.
Mm-hmm. But I'm getting peer pressure from my friends to install Origin again, because they're all playing the Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare game. I'm like, but do I really want to install Origin? It's like, every time I want to play a game for me, I'm like, but do I really want Origin again? It's just one of those life decisions, life choices.
I got it once. I got it once to get the Mass Effect trilogy, and number one and two, Mass Effect 1 wouldn't install, Mass Effect 2 wouldn't launch, and Mass Effect 3 was the only one that worked, but I wanted to play the whole trilogy, and I already had 3 in the Xbox, so I just dumped it at that point.
All right, so let's move on, I guess, just to wrap things up regarding Nintendo. It definitely seems like Nintendo is at this point where either they don't care about making these changes, or they're just, you know, going all in with this family-friendly motto that they can't seem to shake it. And I think it will raise serious concerns about whether or not we're going to see either a brand new console from Nintendo in a year or two, or if they're going to continue to make use of the Wii U and, you know, try to salvage the sinking ship.
See, for me, the Wii U has great potential, but the way Nintendo currently is, it's not going to go pretty, and they're most likely going to make a new console, and they're going to have wasted the Wii U's. Like, it's just the Wii U would be great. It just, I think the company is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, when we think about it, the only M-rated game or hardcore game that I can think of that's coming to it is Bayonetta 2, and that's been one they've been seriously pushing, but one game, again, does not make a console. Where are the other, like, T to M-rated titles? And you mentioned this earlier, Lorison, but M-rated doesn't mean, you know, doesn't have to mean, you know, blood, violence, profanity, and all that. It can just mean challenging gameplay. I mean, if you look at a game like Portal, that game, I think it was rated, I think it was rated T, I believe. I don't think it was rated M, but I'm not sure. But again, that was a game that was a mature game, but it didn't have like the super serious mature themes that we see in other titles.
Yeah, it just had some dark themes necessarily, because you're the last survivor, of course. But like you know, that'd be fine. Like we don't need violence. We just need a bigger variety than a kid running through a cotton candy land, you know? Like, and that's what a lot of Nintendo games seem to be right now.
All right, and I guess to end this section then, I guess here's one last question for you, Larson. If you had go through Nintendo's back catalog of characters, you know, Nintendo, Super Nintendo, those types of games, and had to pick one to basically force them to make a modern-day version of, what game would that be?
Does it have to strictly be Nintendo, or could it be a different developer?
Let's go with Nintendo exclusive. So it could be a third party, but it had to have been a game that was only released on Nintendo.
Only released on Nintendo. I don't even know if I liked any games. Like, I don't think I can remember anything that I liked. Like, Metro, Zelda, Mario, I had played Sonic.
Mm-hmm.
There's not many I could think of. Oh, you know it'd be awesome?
Mm-hmm.
If they re-released that, that wasn't Nintendo, never mind. I can't think of anything that's strictly Nintendo anymore.
What about a third party that was on Nintendo?
Oh, easily, Billy Hatcher. I would love to see a sequel or some kind of, or the game even, well, not really the game redone, because I mean, I can just buy a PC version and mod it myself, mm-hmm. but just as a sequel, it'd be awesome. Yeah. And I think the Wii U would be great for that.
Mm-hmm. For me, it would probably be the Star Tropics series. This was way back in Nintendo. It was sort of like another action-adventure series. The first game had more adventure elements to it. Like, you actually had to solve puzzles, and then you go into like the dungeons, and then the game takes like the Zelda sort of isometric perspective as you try to get through the dungeon, fight the bosses. And it was just a pretty interesting game at the time. The sequel toned back a lot of the adventure, and I think was weaker because of it. But that's still one of the games I want to play. And of course, the other popular answer is, you know, Mother 3 or Earthbound 2. Or I guess Earthbound 3. It's sometimes hard to tell with the naming conventions.
Oh, that, I can't believe I didn't think of Earthbound. That would be great.
I think they finally got it on the Wii U Virtual Shop. You know, again, that's another one of those games that people have been yelling at Nintendo for years. You know, saying, hey, we won't buy this, give us money. And Nintendo's like, no, not yet.
And, oh, that part is just so infuriating. Like, mm-hmm. why can't they just take all of their back catalog and just shove it right up on the Wii, on like the, on their software download thing?
Yeah.
On their shop. Like that, they could instantly make like hundreds and millions of dollars off of it. I know, because I'd go back on my Wii and I'd buy everything I ever wanted mm-hmm. for it.
Yeah, now, obviously, with third-party games, there's probably like some contracts and some IP issues. There's no reason why we don't see a lot more of Nintendo's back catalogs or the third-party exclusive games on there. Although, I do wonder what that's like getting the contract negotiations. Because when I spoke with the guys from Good Old Games, they talked about some of the challenges involved with, you know, getting the IP, getting the rights to reproduce these classic games for a modern audience. So it's got to be similar, maybe even harder, for the console developers. Now, I'm pretty sure Square Enix is pretty, you know, careful with, you know, classic Final Fantasy games, or even Super Mario RPG. Although that did eventually get on there, which was good. But I'm still waiting for, like, games like Blast Corps, Jet Force Gemini. Like, a lot of their N64-era games seems to be very low at the moment.
Yeah.
So with that, I guess let's move on. Is there any other news you found interesting this week, Larson?
Just that.
Okay. In that case, let's move on and talk about a few games that we've played. So, for me, I've been playing Goddess once again. They have long last released the next patch for the game. It only took them 3 months. And what's hilarious is that according to the game screens, they've gone from being 49.5% done to 50.5% done. So, they've gone a big 1% in 3 months. And so, that always inspires confidence. So, this patch was the one that was supposed to fix a lot of the grindiness of Goddess, and instead, it's actually made it worse. They've added more timers in for how long it takes for a character to basically build a house or get belief, which is the game's in-game resource, going. And what's very eerie is that they now have developer commentary from Pierre Molyneux in the game. So every time you unlock a new research or hit a certain threshold, he comes on to talk to you about what's going on in the game or why they decided to do this. So it's kind of weird because he's trying to defend, you know, the game, you know, the gem system, where you can buy gems in the mobile version to speed things up. In the PC version, you can't buy them. yet they're still used for all, like, the boosting and speeding up and removing timers. And he, like, says, oh, this is a good thing, you know, don't worry about it. And I just wonder if he's got, like, some kind of late-game commentary, like, you beat the game or beat the base, and he just says, you know, how the hell did you do this without having to spend money and anything like that? And, again, it's one of those games that the promise is there, but they're making the very stupid mistake of developing GONS as a mobile, free-to-play, monetized version. At the same time, they're trying to develop the PC, you know, fully feature GONS version. And they've even said that the true, quote-unquote, PC development is not going to start for at least another 3, maybe 4 months. Who knows if it gets delayed. So PC gamers have had to deal with, you know, the crappy version for at least 3 months now, plus maybe another 3, 4 months before they actually see improvements. And this just seems like a horrible way of developing a game. What do you think about that, Larson?
Anything that automatically has a version of a game where, oh, well, we need you to pay to buy, mm-hmm. and then a version where there's not a pay to buy, instantly in my book, it's blacklisted.
Mm-hmm. Now, a good example of developers who sort of did this, but they went a different route, would be the guys behind the game Plague Inc., which is sort of like the game Pandemic, where you're trying to create a plague to wipe out all of humanity. So what they did was, they've already developed the mobile version that had, it's free to play, and then you have to spend money to download the rest of the plagues and all that stuff. And now they're working on the early access or the PC version, and they're using the mobile as a baseline, but then they're expanding on it. So if you buy the PC version, all the plagues are free. You don't have to spend any more money. They're going to add, you know, custom scenarios, modding tools, better graphics, stuff like that. And that's a case where they already developed the mobile version, and then they're expanding on that for the PC, where GONS is basically trying to have their cake and eat it too and say, hey, we're going to make this version that's going to be super monetized, but then we're also going to design the other version, and we're just going to do both at the same time. And I think a lot of people are just not falling for it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, their roadmap for the game, it sounds promising, but who knows when they're going to reach that point. And so maybe someday GONS will be this amazing game, but how long is that going to take? I mean, the Kickstarter, I think, was in 2012. So they've already gone way past their expected release date for it. And who knows if they're going to have any goodwill left when, you know, they throw their hands up and say, oh, the game is now done.
Sounds a little cheap.
Mm-hmm. And the other game that I played this week is the latest game from the, I guess he's considered somewhat niche success at this point, is Suda51's Killer is Dead. Larson, have you heard of Suda51 before?
Sounds familiar. Did we talk about it before?
Maybe. He's the developer behind Killer 7, No More Heroes, Lollipop Chainsaw. Basically, like, the few M-Ray games that appear on the GameCube and the Wii, he probably did a few of them.
All right, yeah, I've heard of him then, because I know of Lollipop Chainsaw and No More Heroes. Mm-hmm.
So, Killer's Dead is the latest game from his studio, and according to reports, this is one where he sort of took a back seat to in terms of developing it. And I really don't know if that's good or bad, because I'm not entirely loving Killer's Dead. It's a third-person hack-and-slash or action game. You play as this guy who has a giant robot right arm, or is it left arm, it's hard to tell, and he uses a samurai sword, and he basically goes around killing killers. Like, he's like the bounty hunter type deal. So the game continues to have that really, you know, stylized cel-shaded look, which is great. But again, like all of his previous games, the combat is just very basic. You're basically just pressing X, you know, over and over again to slash up guys. There seems to be, at least for the PC version, a delay with some of the button commands. So when I try to block, it takes like an extra second for him to raise his sword up, which means that enemies get to hit you in between there. And the game just, everything about it just feels very, I guess, plain, very derivative of combat. But of course, the story is crazy and out there. And here's the other part of Killer's Dead that it, I think it sparked some controversy, is the game's quote-unquote gigolo mode, where you have to seduce women in order to get them to give you special weapons to use in later levels. So the whole point is you're staring at them, and you have to try to stare at them without them catching you. And you have to give them gifts to make them fall in love with you, and then you just go around the world doing this. And yeah,
that reminds me of in Tales of Symphonia for GameCube, there was one of the characters, LOC, could get an addition. He could get a special title, which would give him a special bonus if you talk to every female in both worlds.
Yeah.
It's always funny.
Yeah, but this just seems very, like, weird. And the worst part is that it's basically required to do this minigame because it's the only way to get the special weapons. And according to an interview Su-51 gave, he said that he wasn't really responsible for that and they wanted some kind of minigame. And that's what they came up with, which is never really a good sign. Because, you know, with all the cases of people complaining about misogyny and just, you know, discrimination against women in the game industry, this is not exactly the time to be making a mode like that.
Mm-hmm. That, yeah, to say, oh, well, we just kind of did it. It's like, oh, so you didn't even think about how it's viewed as or how it may affect people. Like,
Yeah, and the whole game just, like, I played, like, 5 or 6 levels in. I just got completely bored of the game and just frustrated because the combat never seemed to evolve beyond just pressing X, time a block, and just keep repeating that over and over again, which was just like No More Heroes in a sense. And the overall, like, I guess, and like the pacing also suffers. The first level of the game is literally a tutorial of you learning how to move and control the camera. That's one level of the game. And then level 2 teaches you how to swing your sword. So like the pacing of the game is also very not right. It just seems like pacing is conflicting with the story. And this just seems to be his MO now, is that story and gameplay never seem to get together and coalesce. It seems like they focus on story first and then gameplay is like 3rd or 4th down the list. And a lot of people are just wondering if he really was just a one-hit wonder with Killer 7, because that game, it worked because it was so unexpected that a lot of the faults were sort of pushed aside for what was there. But now that we're up to like his 4th or 5th game, it's very hard to say if he's still going to be able to make these titles in the future.
Well, that's probably, if that's how people are reacting now, I mean, that's probably how it's going to be, because you can't, like, if you have a good story, you can't give your gameplay a second thought. It rips you away from the story and from being submerged into it if you're getting frustrated by simply trying to block something, like, because that frustration rises, especially if it's not, like, just a one-time thing, if it happens every time. Like, then you're completely pulled out of the game, and you're more focused on just killing this one guy without dying or losing half your health or anything. Like, it's, doesn't make for a good game, unfortunately.
Yeah. And that's why I was thinking, that maybe the best thing for him to do would be to maybe move to PC development and focus on making, like, narrative-focused titles. You know, games like Gone Home, Dear Esther, where the story is at the forefront, and that's what people come to expect. Like, you don't play a game like Gone Home expecting, you know, riveting first-person shooting action. You're playing it for the story, and that is definitely where I think Su-51's strengths are, with creating these very insane stories, very great characters and worlds. But then, like, when it comes to actually, like, exploring these worlds, you're just left feeling very disappointed by it.
I mean, if you think the story is really great, then maybe that's what they should just focus on, or either that, or they should, I mean, unfortunately, maybe hire somebody who maybe hire a couple people, like a small team or something, to actually get a good game mechanic system in of some kind, even if it's not just like a narrative. You know, what you suggested, I think, is quite possibly the best idea for what they are having to deal with. But you know, there's always that option too, where if what they're doing is not working, maybe hire some outside sources to help them complete what they set out to do.
Yeah. Now, with the game Shadows of the Damned, that was another game from Su-51. I believe that game, he did co-develop that game with Shinji Mikami. He was the guy who created Devil May Cry, Resident Evil. So that was probably his most gameplay-involved title. But even then, that people complained about that feeling derivative because it had like the same over-the-shoulder Resident Evil 4 style, felt very clunky. So it's definitely one of those things that I just don't know how he's going to continue making his games, whether he's going to move to story focus or he's going to keep trying to chase having great gameplay along with story. So with that, Lorson, what games have you been playing this week?
So I've been playing a game called Really Big Sky, which was released, I think, around 2011, and I got it now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a game that is a twin shooter set in space, and it's a bullet hell type of game. There's a lot of enemies, a lot of things to avoid and things to shoot down, mm-hmm. a lot of things to collect as well, plus a multiplier. And the game is roguelike as well, in the sense that no matter where you start, it'll always be like kind of different. Like it's just a side scroller, but the enemies will be different.
Mm-hmm.
The how fast you might meet the like these really big problems are different. Like there's a couple of things I call it the white field of death, because if you touch the white clouds, then you die.
Mm-hmm.
There's also like a boss type thing, which isn't necessarily a boss because you just have to beat him and then you can go on through and you still continue. Mm-hmm. I think, because I always die at him anyway. It's quite challenging. You just use like your keyboard keys or your WASD and then your mouse. And what's it kind of like a unique feature of the game is you have two guns and then you have a drill, and there'll be times where like you get a warning that says planet upcoming,
mm-hmm.
and you have to switch over to your drill and you can drill on through it. And while you're going through the planet, you can find upgrades.
Okay.
And that can really help out in the long run. Such as a shield upgrade, laser upgrade, a bomb upgrade, or how fast your things shoot, which is personally my favorite. And every time you die, you whatever points you end up with are points you save up and you can spend in the shop to upgrade your ship. Mm. Right now, what I have is it's kind of low. Everything seems to be really low at the moment. And it doesn't seem to be affecting the game like at all. But I think like the farther I'll get in, the more I'll notice it, because you know it's like kind of like an exponential increase every time you buy something. So it'll go from like a $12 upgrade to like a 20, and then up to like a 34, and then up to 60, and then eventually 100, and then eventually it's like my next upgrade. I have to wait till I have 500 points alone just mm-hmm. to get a power upgrade.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much roguelike, like. Besides unlocking like new stuff for the ship, do they add like new enemies and stuff like that over time?
I frankly can't tell you because I'm just so horrible at the game. Like I can only play a couple of times straight, and I'll just keep dying like literally within 2 minutes every single time. And to me, that's incredibly frustrating. I finally mm-hmm. went back to the first the menu screen, and it said I had unlocked something, but I was really mad, so I just left. I didn't even bother reading what it was. But it's kind of fun because it's short. If you just had like a couple minutes to play something, you can just start it up and go at it.
Okay. Does it have different difficulty levels, or is it just one straight difficulty?
It has different game modes
okay.
that I know of, but the only one I have unlocked is Classic. I think you have to actually be good at the game to unlock anything else, so mm-hmm. that's going to be an uphill battle.
Yeah, I think I have that on my Steam list. It must have been a game, who knows when I actually bought it. It's hard to tell at this point. Maybe I'll install and see what it's all about.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, but the graphics are something that reminds me of Trip Bit Beat. It's kind of spastic, very, very spastic, and this one is like I want to say Trip Bit Beat on acid. Like, there's just colors and flashes everywhere, so like if you're kind of, I don't know, epileptic or maybe like sensitive to flashing lights, I'd probably suggest you don't play it, because even the title screen is kind of unique in itself, of the bright colors on a black background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was telling you about this before the cast, but it reminds me of that game Super Hexagon, that I can't play that game because I started like get a headache from staring at just the crazy colors that just like start filling the screen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's exactly what it is, because the more you shoot, because it's a very dark background, and then when you shoot, your lasers are like white and blue, and mm-hmm. when they hit things, it just causes more explosions, which are more flashes of light, like It's very beautiful. It's just it can be kind of annoying at times.
It sounds a lot like the game Geometry Wars that came out for the Xbox. Did you ever play that?
I have not.
That was another interesting twin stick shooter. It was all about you had to survive for as long as you can. It didn't really have any like real metagame progression. It's just score chasing. But every time you kill enemies, they explode in like fireworks, and it just gets very hard to keep track of your ship. Because when you have like 200 things chasing after you and you kill them all, the whole screen just turns into like a little laser light show.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at a screenshot now. Yeah, it looks kind of exactly like this, just with little spaceships instead.
Mm-hmm.
it's frustrating at times.
Yep. But yeah, sounds like an interesting game. Maybe I'll try loading that up when we're done talking here. Okay. Yeah. All right. So we're going to move along pretty quickly here. So we're going to get to the big topic. And this is one that I wanted to talk about last week, but of course no one was on to talk about. I didn't really want to talk to myself for an hour. And that is the sort of the issue that we're seeing with game journalism and morality or integrity with the YouTube generation. So for those of you who don't know what's going on, 2 weeks, it was reported that YouTube Let's Players, Total Biscuit, and the Yogscast basically came out and said that, yes, they do receive money from developers to spotlight certain games and essentially do their advertising on their channels. Now, with the Let's Players, these guys are not game journalists in the sense that, you know, they work for a major site, they, you know, work for a company. They basically turn their Let's Plays into a business. And with Yogscast, they said something about how that they agree to it, that they'll receive a cut of the profits for, I guess, the month that they talk about the game. And we don't know what Total Biscuit gets. And this is raising a dilemma in terms of the integrity of this and just about how very finicky and gray game journalism has become. In the past, there was always that seed of doubt with game journalists, like whether or not they're being paid, you know, to give a game a good review. Who can forget everyone complaining about IGN saying, you know, that they receive, you know, the more money they get, the higher the review they'll get for a game. There's the issue with GameSpot when they fired the game journalists for giving Kane and Lynch a bad review. So there's always been this very, like, seedy relationship with journalists in the game industry. And part of the issue is that, unlike other industries, where the journalists are sort of separate, like, they can stay on their own, game journalists pretty much rely on game developers to stay afloat. We see this with game ads, exclusive reviews and previews, and just the general funding that's needed. And so this sort of puts a lot of game journalists in the pocket of game developers. So I guess the first question then for you, Lorson, is like, what do you think about like game reviews to like today? Like, do you trust when you see a review up on IGN or GameSpot or sites like that?
Oh, absolutely not. I haven't trusted that stuff since I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
It is very based. Like, it was a couple of me and my friends had gotten together and we had talked about how all, like, the same games, like, kept, like, all, like, you know, that it was at that year when a lot of games were getting between 8 and, like, 10.
Mm-hmm.
But it was almost like every game was. So at that point, that's when I stopped trusting them because obviously that was some integrity thing, or they literally had no idea what they were talking about. And so I decided to give them the benefit of the doubt and go with my later option. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't trust anybody. I wouldn't go to popular channels. I would try to read, like, other people's reviews on, like, different websites, maybe a YouTube channel, but it would have to be one that wasn't popular
mm-hmm.
at that point, because that, to me, I always feel like this always has a chance of happening. Like, even in today, like, stuff gets reviewed by websites. Like, you know, websites are always being found out. They're being paid for something,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, at this point, you have to be, I think, yeah, before you just go off one review, you have to be very, very careful. And you should really, you should really look into and get a couple of opinions. Just like when you're going to be buying a new or used car, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, like, games are like the same thing. Like most games, like, it could be like a $40 investment and it would be like years of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I don't want to drop that much money and then play a game for only a couple hours and find out I absolutely hate it or something doesn't work as well as somebody said. So I feel like this is not shocking to me, like, mm-hmm. at all that this happened.
Okay. Now, what do you think about the actual idea that developers are paying Let's Players to basically spotlight their game? They're effectively...
Oh, it's very, very dirty practice.
Mm-hmm.
Very dirty. And to me, that makes me feel like that they are so not confident, or they don't have any trust in their own games that they make, that they have to pay other people to tell me that it's good. Mm-hmm. That's when I become very iffy. Like, if they released, like, a whole list of companies that did that, then I would most certainly, probably, I'd put them on, like, a, like, blacklist of mine, as I always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Just because if they have to pay other people to tell us how great their games are, then maybe their games are not worth playing at all.
Now, in terms of the actual Let's Players themselves, what do you think about this practice of them accepting money? Now, obviously, with YouTube, for those of you who don't know, the majority of the revenue that someone on YouTube gets is from the ad revenue. And this has become a very hotly contested topic over the last few years. There's, of course, Nintendo saying that they won't receive a cut from their games being shown on there. There's developers saying, you know, there's the Phil Fish, another Twitter meltdown from him, saying that he thinks that people are stealing money from him when they put up Let's Plays. So it's become very much a big business having a successful YouTube channel. So what do you think, Larson, like when the actual Let's Player basically comes out and says, hey, you know, these games that I spotlight, you know, they're giving me money to put up on my channel.
Oh, they're also dirty. That's also corruption. I mean, it goes both ways. It's like a company paying off a politician, you know, like so that they support whatever they want to happen or not have passed. Like, they're both at fault for that. So, like, I haven't really seen much of Total Biscuit and Yogcast, but at this point, no, I'm never going to watch them just because of this. Like, I like to say I have like a high ethic and moral standing, and I try to keep that very consistent, especially with what I say. Like, now that they pay for it, that means anything they say cannot be trusted. Even if they come out and announce they're not taking any more money, like, I can't believe them because corruption still happens. I mean, that might be a very extreme word because they are just like what, Let's Players or reviewers, but at the same time, it should all be held up at a high standard. You don't pay people to say great things. Sure, you should pay people to review your product, but not necessarily to say that they're great when they're not, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, hey, like, I'll give you, you know, so much money if you review our product, like, just give your honest opinion about it, that's fine. But when it's like, hey, we need you to say this is a great game, like, please have it up for a while, like, maybe do a Let's Play for a couple of episodes, like, that's not okay. Definitely not okay.
I think what has pissed off a lot of people is the fact that sites like Total Biscuit and Yogscast, they didn't come out at the store and say they were going to do this. It had to be found out, as in they didn't want people to know that they were receiving money. And as you said, Larson, that very much reeks of corruption when someone has to discover you accepting money instead of you just coming out and saying, hey, you know, these guys are paying us a lot of money so we can talk about their game. And again, this goes back to that very seedy nature of game journalism. Like, if you look at the post I put up this past week, there's that famous picture of Jeff Knightley or Keeley standing in front of the Halo Doritos poster and the Mountain Dew on the other side of him. And he's supposed to be a professional game critic, and he's basically shilling Doritos and Mountain Dew along with Halo.
But with those two, though, at this point, I kind of see it as humor, and also as those two have also been literally been one of the biggest video game backers in, like, history. And although it's, oh, I think so anyway, you know, because they're always promoting it. They always have game promotions going on their products. Regardless, like, you may say I'm hypocritical, and you totally can, but, like, it's kind of like a hard thing. Like, when I see it, I never take it seriously because I don't really buy those products anyway, and I never will. Like, Doritos game or Mountain Dew game fuel, it's like, are you kidding me? Like, all you need is water. Like, like, calm down, Mountain Dew. Like that's just like, I don't know. I find it more humorous than anything.
Now, getting back to the argument of, you know, being paid off, this one things I've sort of had to address in the post I wrote, where I basically outline pretty much Game Wisdom's policy, that with console and handheld games, those are all games that I bought on my own. With a lot of PC games, especially from indie developers, I have received press copies, but I pretty much don't let that judge or be a weight in my review. Because, I mean, I basically tore Transistor and Mobius apart, and those are both press copies. I'm pretty sure Jane Jensen, the one who created Mobius, will probably not speak to me anymore after that.
Well, like, you know, and this is why, like, sites like yours are okay, because, like, you know, you'll give the honest truth, and that's how it should be. Like, if a game is terrible, say it's terrible. If a game is like, pretty good except for maybe, like, these three parts, then say that. Like, I mean, you get money for it, but then, like, you lose respect to people, and, like, you may lose your job. Like, you're going to lose revenue. You're going to lose customers and business. Like, that's just what happens. Like, when politicians get found out they're corrupt, they have to resign or they're going to get voted out. Like, that's just kind of what happens.
And I mean, with this site, there's no ads on the site. The only real money that's coming in is the few bucks we're getting for the Patreon campaign each month. But that's pretty much it. There's no, you know, corporate investors, because I really have too much integrity to say to have someone pay me off to get a good review, because I just couldn't do that. I just hold myself to too high of a standard. Now, going back to game journalism itself, it just seems like it's very interesting how things have sort of shifted. We went from magazines to the internet to now YouTube. I saw someone was telling me that the YouTube celebrities are now, you know, they're very big. Like, we're seeing a lot of people who get on YouTube, and it has really become a business. And that's kind of very crazy. But then again, though, it was crazy to think about digital distribution and Steam cards. So who knows where these trends are actually going to lead. Mm-hmm. Now, with, like, it's another thing that it's very much a gray area. Now, I do agree with you, Lorson, about how, like, getting money to look at these games, even if you come out and admit, it still seems very skeevy, very corrupting. But then again, it also raises that problem with and how these guys are supposed to get paid, but then that gets back to ad revenue. So I guess here's another question for you then. Do you think that the people who are basically turning YouTube and their channels into careers, do you think that's actually a viable solution? Or do you think that's just, you know, like, it just won't work?
That's kind of a tough question. So you're asking me that with ad revenue, if they accept this money, should it?
Basically, do you see, like, YouTube as essentially a way of creating a career? Like, saying that you're a professional, you know, Let's Play, or you're a professional YouTube video maker. Like, is that something that could actually become a business for someone?
I'd have to say yes, because there's a lot of people who, like, want to do things and make videos, and there's a lot of people who do, and they do survive off of YouTube, mm-hmm. and they survive off of like, other things, you know, like ad revenue on websites websites or comic websites and stuff like that. Like, I know that that's their way of actually living. Like, I've seen people quit their jobs and, like, announce, like, oh yeah, well, I don't need to work because I get so many, like, hits every day. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think it is. I think it's definitely a viable way, and I think it's definitely a good way to make money if you know what you're doing, but, like, don't quit your job and expect to make money.
Mm-hmm. And I guess here's another, like, is following up on that question. We saw magazine or print journalism with the game industry sort of die, that it's been slowly declining. I know Nintendo Power went out, and I think it's very hard to even think of how many actual print magazines are left that haven't moved to the internet. So do you think that we're going to see another movement? Do you think, like, these websites may go down in favor of, you know, YouTube and Let's Players basically picking up the slack?
No, because those mm-hmm. websites are going to always have access to, mm-hmm. are always going to have first access to things, and things are going to be leaked to them, and they're going to be able to get their hands on them, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's just how it is. I think there may not be as much as a powerhouse as they were back in the day when, like, the internet first came out, and, like, because, you know, IGN was huge, mm-hmm. was absolutely huge when it first came out. Like, it just boomed. But, like, now, like, I don't know many people that still go there, mm-hmm. or any people that still go there, but it's still going to exist, definitely, for sure, because it's still going to have, like, first looks. Like, mm-hmm. well, even when I read other articles or watch other YouTubes, like, they'll reference them, of course. Like, yeah, of course, they're both going to be relevant. I just think maybe the YouTube, like, Let's Plays will be a little bigger because you can actually see them playing, and they can, like, you can hear their input while they're playing it. Well, but IGN will still be around, just not nearly as big.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any game sites that you do follow? Like, do you go on, like, Rock Paper Shotgun, Polygon, anything like that?
Not really. Like, I mostly follow your website, and then I'll follow developers mm-hmm. on like, their personal Facebook or Twitter pages or Tumblr or journals or whatever, and I'll just follow them and follow updates. Mostly, I'll see, like, on my Facebook, because I'm friends with plenty of other people who are also into games. Like, they'll post something new, and then I'll check it out. Like, but that's about the only time I'll really adventure off into the gaming website community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is definitely becoming harder to basically find quality writing. I think part of it is that you really need to learn and know the actual writers themselves. And we do have, I think there have been, like, several people who have become popular that way. I know a lot of the PC Gamer editors back in the day sort of became somewhat famous for writing quality pieces, like Bruce Garrick, and even Tom Chick I think he wrote for Computer Gaming World. He did stuff on 1UP at the time. So these guys do sort of become, they do get a following, but then with how the internet has sort of evolved, now there's, you know, dozens of sites, it sort of becomes, like, they sort of become lost in the shuffle, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard to really follow a lot of these sites. I've been sort of, I don't really read too many game sites either, to be honest. I mean, I go on IGN just to see, you know, the news, but it's not like I actually use them as a trusted source for whether or not a game is good. I mean, I would say my staples is basically Escapist, Polygon, and pretty much like IGN or Giant Bomb. But as I said, it's not for like game reviews. Like, I don't go to these sites to figure out whether or not I'm going to buy a game. I go to them mainly for the news. And as you said, Lorson, that's one area where the websites do have an advantage, is that they can get these exclusives, they get these interviews. Because the YouTubers don't, they can't really sit down and talk to a developer like someone who works at Gamasutra or IGN can do.
Right, like they can't just call up like a big head developer and be like, hey, can I ask you a couple of questions on my YouTube channel?
Yeah. And there are some great advantages for print as opposed to voice and video. So you can, you know, use that as a scholarly reference, or it becomes easier to grasp that information for a lot of people. One of my favorite things I like to read is from the developer Ernest Adams. He writes this yearly series about basically all the bad game design decisions and stuff people make, and it sort of becomes like this big collection of don'ts for game design that I love. And I'm going to hopefully be able to talk to him on the cast soon, because I think that'll be a really great conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So I think with that, like we said at the beginning, we want to make this a somewhat quick cast, well, quicker than other casts. And I'm going to try to get this all edited tonight, so by the time you hear this, it should be Monday afternoon-ish, hopefully. So, with that, I guess, to wrap things up, Lorson, do you have any final thoughts or anything you want to add before we end?
Just thanks for having me, and thanks for the great discussion. It's kind of nice not having Ken here once in a while, because then I don't have to interrupt one of you to say what I want to say.
Well, we can always have you as a backup co-host then.
Sounds wonderful.
Awesome. I guess for me, I guess to wrap things up, first with Nintendo, again, I don't think Nintendo really is going to change. I mean, they've been hit against the wall so many times between developers saying they don't want to work with them, you know, the constant profit losses. I mean, we've said this on previous casts, but at this point, Nintendo pretty much has infinite money. I mean, they did go number one undisputed for, wow, at least, what do we figure, maybe 10, 15 years of the industry. They were number one. So they can pretty much do whatever they want, but unlike Steam and Valve, they're not really using that money as an advantage. And again, I think both of us and a lot of other people want to see Nintendo just go crazy, you know, make something completely non-Nintendo-like, and then just see if it works, because what they're doing now is just trying to empty a sinking ship that has a hole in it. Like, it's just not work. And I guess for game journalism, it's one of those things that we're moving so quickly as an industry that it's hard to create these standards. And this even goes back to coming up with, like, rules and just, like, general foundations for game design. There's just so many different avenues of the game industry that you can't really set up regulations. Because how do you regulate, you know, some guy's random YouTube channel the same way you would regulate a site like Gamasutra or IGN? It's just not possible. We're not a centralized industry. And I think I've said this on previous casts, but something tells me that a lot of this, I think, will be decided by the end of the decade. Now, whether or not that means that, you know, YouTube becomes dominant or websites become dominant or whatever, that, I think, is too up in the air. I don't think anyone can really predict that. But I think a lot of our answers will come by the time we get to the end. I guess after that, you know, very dark and morbid topic, we can wrap things up for this lovely Sunday afternoon. It looks like it's nice and there's no clouds out. I don't know if it's how the weather is where you are, Lorson.
Well, I have blackout curtains, so I can't tell.
That's what I need at some point. But yeah, I got the sun beaming in. So, you know, go outside, take a walk, have a nice Sunday stroll after us, you know, talking about corruption and people being bought off and game journalism and all that. Well, actually, it'll be Monday by the time you hear it, so take a Monday walk, then. That's my advice to you. So, as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, you have several ways of doing that. First, if you're interested in writing a guest piece or being a guest on the podcast, you can send me an email under Submissions Wanted on the front page. That will take you to the guidelines as well as an email link. And if you would like to contribute to our monthly Patreon campaign, where I'm trying to secure monthly funding to basically start making improvements and growing Game Wisdom, you can do that from the Patreon banner on the front page as well. Any amount will be greatly appreciated, and basically it will go towards making the site even better. So, with that said, Lorsen, again, it was great having you on tonight.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you tonight.
Yeah. Hopefully we can have you back on. Like I said, maybe we can have you as a backup co-host when Ken's not around.
I'm okay with that.
All right. And for those of you listening, thanks again for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week. Take care, everybody.